Kyle Schlesinger is a poet living in Austin, but from Rhode Island. Some recent poetry books include Sidney Omar's Wild Children, Far and Away, and Let's Drift. Scholarly works include A Poetics of the Press, Dwell Time, and Aaron Kohick, and Threads with Aaron Kohick, and Threads Talk with Steve Clay. He is a proprietor of Cuneiform Press, a literary arts organization, and the director of the Graduate School of Publishing at the University of Houston, and I can't wait to hear what he has to say. Kyle?
Well, thank you all for showing up tonight, especially because the sun came out. I think what I wanted to do today is break this talk up into three parts. And first, I'll talk a little bit about, or just read you the intro from Charles Olson at Goddard College. And this book came out 5 or 6 years ago, and I realized today that I haven't done any sort of like launch for it yet. So this is like the first, and I feel like the Charles Olson thing was an obvious idea for a community like this in Gloucester. And then, rather than read Charles Olson, I thought I would play you the cassette tapes that I used to transcribe this thing. The project took me almost like 10 years from start to finish, working on and off. But you'll hear in the tape, it was a mess. So hopefully we've kind of taken this cassette tape and put it into a legible form here in this book. And then the third part, because the thing I like most about traveling around the country and overseas and whatever and doing poetry readings and stuff like that is not listening to myself talk, but getting to meet people like yourselves. So because this whole thing is kind of couched in progressive and holistic education at Goddard, I'm going to ask you all to sort of forego the logical Q&A thing and to talk a little bit about a meaningful experience that you had in education, and that can be in or outside of school, something that happened to you that changed the way that you thought about what it means to learn things, epistemology, ontology, kind of like what it means to be a thinker in the world. But I'd like you to ground it in an anecdote or experience. So three parts. We'll start with the me reading, and then we'll listen to Charles reading, and then I want to listen to you guys talk about a meaningful experience that you had that shaped your way of thinking about learning in the world. Fair enough? Yeah?
Sounds good.
All right. So this is Charles Olson at Goddard College, April 12th through 14th, 1962, in Plainfield, Vermont. And I dedicated this book to Robert Creeley, poet, and Will Hamlin, who was a professor of mine at Goddard, who, and both of these guys were at Black Mountain College. So there's a connection between Goddard and sort of this Deweyan model of experiential learning and Black Mountain, where, of course, Charles Olson was the rector for some years. That starts with a little epigraph from Olson, a letter to Hank Chapin, dated April 25th, 1962, right around the time he was at Goddard. What the young know today is the price is huge, and already are clear that institutions are dinosaurs, and sanctions are pitiful gasps, and procedures all gone dead in their mouths and minds. The task would seem to be to get the new things sorted and straight for all to have some idea of paths or procedures to follow, other than abandonment and suicide, guerrilla and soft. Um, W.W. Gregg was a bibliographer and textual scholar, and the intro begins with a quote from him. "The process of transcription is characterized by variation. I stumbled on these recordings of Charles Olson when I was a student in a seminar on the history of medieval education that was conducted in the basement of the Elliott D. Pratt Library at Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont in 1996. The course was taught by archivist and volunteer firefighter Forrest Davis, who, after graduating from Harvard College, joined the Air Force in 1943 and served in the Pacific until the end of World War II. After the war, he returned to his studies at Harvard Divinity School on the GI Bill, and shortly thereafter became the dean at Goddard, where he worked until 1967. He left to pursue careers at other universities, but when he retired, returned to rural Vermont, where he taught part-time and contributed much to our understanding of Goddard through his extraordinary histories, Things Were Different in Royce's Day, and earth.goddard.edu, both published by his own Adamant Press. There were four 90-minute cassette tapes of Olson, each neatly labeled with a typewriter, recordings of Robert Creeley and Richard Grossinger, who will be here next week, were also on cassette tape, reading at Goddard, in the same drawer as the Olson tapes, but the sound quality of both were less than desirable. Davis gave me permission to take the cassette to one of the listening stations on the first floor of the library, where I spent days transcribing the recordings, donning plastic, classic DJ headphones, rewind, pause, play, rewind, pause, play, repeat. The annotated transcript was revised with Robert Creeley, who is my dissertation supervisor up at Buffalo, where I studied. And this kind of, it wasn't like a seminar, it was kind of like a reading group where we studied, just a group of friends got together and talked about the relationship between Olson and Melville, and it was kind of a study in affinity. And we had Creeley there and Susan Howe and Bob Bertoff all kind of chiming in and contributing to that conversation, which was delightful. Then the cassette tapes were digitized and uploaded to Penn Sound. An early draft of these recordings also appeared at the Slott Foundation. In the spring or mud season of 1962, Olson descended upon the experimental college to read from the Maximus poems in the distances and to lecture on Melville. His captivating performance sparked lively debates with the audience on the nature of myth, history, etymology, narrative, knowledge, and sexuality. Charles Olson at Goddard College is an enthralling and indispensable annotated transcript that celebrates the intersection of Olson's poetics and a hopeful moment in American education. Olson's poetry reading was recorded in the Haybarn Theater on April 12th, and his lecture on Melville was recorded in the same location 2 days later, according to the cassette tape labels. Olson began his event by stating his problem with poetry readings, quote, "It gets to be kind of a bore because it's become a performing art. You feel as though you have an audience and as if you're supposed to do a concert or something." He concludes, "I don't think I believe in verse in this respect at all. As a matter of fact, I know I don't." Hearing this as a student then engaged with medieval education, it struck me that poetry has always been a performing art, even if it wasn't thought of as such at the time. In The Muse Learns to Write, Greek scholar Eric Havelock examines the ways consciousness changes when oral cultures become literate and suggests how new forms of communication affect the content and meaning of language. Olson shared many of Havelock's interests and even published a review in his preface to Plato in the first issue of Niagara Frontier Review in 1964. From Dada to the Bauhaus to the beat poets reading poems with jazz musicians, by 1962, poetry as performing art had become a staple in 20th century American and European poetic practices. At a time when some historians were lamenting the loss of the common culture of reading, Marshall McLuhan published his tour de force, The Gutenberg Galaxy, also in 62, wherein he announced the end of the printing press's monarchy, examining the interaction between mass media and the transformation of global consciousness with a trans-historical context. A few years later, ethnopoetic pioneers Jerome Rothenberg and Dennis Tedlock would introduce the expansive history of poetry's oral traditions to the avant-garde, while poets such as David Anton would blur the lines between poetry and performance art, much in the way that performance artists many associated with Fluxus and Something Else Press used language as a visual and oral muse and medium. In the days before PenSound and UbuWeb, hearing poets read was a rare occasion for most people. There was some poetry on vinyl, but one couldn't hear a fraction of the diverse number of poets whose readings are represented online today. During the ages of cassette and compact disc, there was a dearth of professionally produced and digitized studio recordings, but a rise in amateur productions, creating a more eclectic and decentralized record of poetry's sound. Cassette tapes were easy to dub and quickly became part of poetry's cultural currency. Olson mentions that a reading of Creeley, reading at Goddard, quote, ran from this room, was it, into our kitchen in Gloucester, directly almost. I think it was a matter of hours. It was like hotcakes. At the time I encountered these tapes, I had been reading Olson for a year or two, but still felt baffled, if not bombarded, by the bard's esoteric references, unconventional poetic forms, and the mass of Maximus, etc. Sitting in the listening room, hearing Olson read his poems for the first time was an unforgettable experience. Projective verse became an immediate, irrevocably apparent source of energy and information. Everything changed and was charged by the sound. To reverse the old adage, listening is an aid to memory. Goddard's founder, Tim Pitkin, conceived of the college as a place for plain living and hard thinking. Goddard was celebrated for its progressive and experiential practices that, like Black Mountain, were largely inspired by John Dewey's philosophy of education. In the 60s, the student population was approaching its peak with just over 1,000 students. Big school, right? When I graduated, there were, I think, like 5 or 6 graduates in my class. It was, you know, past its prime. So there were like 1,000 students back in the 60s when Allen Ginsberg claimed that it was the center of the universe. According to Goddard alum Don and Susan Wilcox, the reading was organized by Paul Wiener, a student at the time remembered fondly as a honky-tonk piano player who later became a kind of traveling cabaret act calling himself Sweet Pie. Wiener eventually stopped touring to raise a family and became known as the Naked Book Guy and proprietor of the Reader's Oasis Books in Quartzsite, Arizona. Has anyone ever been there? There's a
movie about the guy.
Yeah, I've seen some stuff on YouTube, you know, him sitting in his thong playing the piano in his bookstore.
I knew that guy.
Did you?
Was he there when you were there, Willie?
Yeah, I was there in 63, and I got a couple of licks from him. I didn't, you know, he wasn't playing naked yet, but he was good. I'll show you.
That would be great. Does anyone have a piano? Jumping ahead, Tom Clark in his Olson biography wrote this about Olson's time at Goddard and tour through New England that summer, or spring. On an April reading swing through upper New England, he took Betty along, but her presence did little to curb his need to force the public moment with artificial spirits. At Dartmouth, English professor John Finch, who had set up Olson's reading, could not help noticing his former eccentric roommate was acting more rambunctious than ever before. At Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont, Olson's next stop, He was at his outgoing best for the first few days of a week-long reading lecture visit, helping a young but receptive student audience through his latest mytho-historical Maximus run by airing his views on the poet's role as myth-maker. Reformulated, he said, following discussions a few days earlier with Dartmouth French poetry expert Raymond Guthrie. Guthrie had pointed out to him that the medieval French verb trobar meant to find, allowing a word root fanatic Olson to link the troubadour poets with Herodotus, Homer, and himself in the tradition of the investigative storyteller, the man who finds out the words. But by the end of the week, both the poet himself and his wife had been summoned before the college judiciary committee, reprimanded for taking part in a wild drinking party on campus, and sternly told to abide by community laws while there. End quote. Longtime Goddard professor of literature and fellow Black Mountaineer, Will Hamlin, confirmed the report when I interviewed him about the college's history. Quote, "We threw that louse out of here," unquote. He also referred to Creeley as a, quote, "love poet." Will was a student from BMC's founder, Black Mountain College's founder, John Andrew Rice, was still rector, long before Robert Duncan, John Cage, Merce Cunningham, Robert Milderwell, William and Elaine de Kooning, or Olson arrived on the scene. Hamlin wrote, but never to my knowledge finished, an excellent memoir about his time at Black Mountain. Rice once professed, quote, "All colleges should be intense. When they fold, they fold." He felt that the problem with institutions was that they were designed to survive, to sustain themselves regardless of their function or relevance. Like any entity, Rice felt that the college should not live beyond its necessary years, and like Black Mountain decades later, Goddard shut down the campus early in the 21st century, signifying the end of progressive higher education in America. Early in the recording, someone asked, "You don't mind using a tape recorder, do you?" To which the poet responds, "No, as a matter of fact, I'm just going to watch it like a fire. Let's sit here and watch that tape." The poet goes on to present an exegesis on the second century dialectician Maximus of Tyre in order to offer the uninitiated audience a context for the Maximus poems. Olson's critique of the poetry reading is the perfect introduction for a tremendous performance where he reads from the third and fifth volume of the Maximus poems with selections from The Distances. From time to time, the audience asks Olson to reread the poems. Other times, Olson reads poems twice or starts over in an effort to accurately perform the written word. "You dig? You want that again? I don't know. Call me if you'd like any of these again. I have that problem with scoring. It's more difficult than music. Like one writes music, one doesn't play it. That's the problem with this kind of performing situation. I'm not Beethoven." The technical and conceptual problems of transcription have been variously addressed by Havelock, as well as textual critic Jerome McGann, poet Jerome Rothenberg, and multidisciplinary artist Carolee Schneeman, who was once told by Olson that when the cunt began to speak, when women were finally allowed to perform, it was the beginning of the end of Greek theater. Huh. Although the reading and lecture are built around extant text, there are performances of thought thinking. Much of what is said is improvisatory, humorous, and insightful. I've done little to alter Olson's words, yet like any other form of translation, transcription is not transparent. I've refrained from including most speech whiskers, as Peter Gizzi calls them, in the preface to The House That Jack Built, which is Spicer. And I've omitted most of the stutters, grunts, and other sounds that are audible in the recordings, but have ultimately proven to be distracting in print. It's kind of technical. And then I just end by thanking the people who helped me with this, particularly, and a lot of them sadly no longer living, but shouts out to Ralph Maud and Robert Berthoff and Robert Creeley and Richard Grossinger and Will Hamlin and and Charles Olson Jr., who when I asked him permission to do this book, he sent me back a little piece of stationery and he just wrote, "Go for it," which I thought was pretty nice. So now I just want to play you, maybe 10 minutes of the recording and do a little collective listening together. Does that sound all right?
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really glad I'm going to be here for a few days. Since I'd really rather talk about poetry or read somebody else's than myself, being at some stage of existence would make that sense.
Louder.
Yeah.
I've got one good ear.
Huh? No. I mean, just watch it. Like a file. Let's sit here and watch that thing. What happens when it just goes on? I don't say anything. That's that problem of reading. It's not, you've got to be kind of a bore because
does anyone want to read along?
It's become performing art. You feel that they have an audience and you're supposed to do a concert or something. And I don't think I believe in verse in this respect at all. In fact, I know I don't. This Blazer asked me to introduce myself. Not even a fruitcake. I suppose I'm here because my co-agitator, Mr. Crilly, was here a year ago. And in fact, I feel very much at home because that previous tape, as far as I know, of a reading was, unless you've had someone in between, is Crilly's tape, which ran from this room, was it, into our kitchen in Gloucester. Directly, almost, I think it was in a matter of hours. It was like hotcakes. Have you had a poet read since?
Not
since. No. Then I see it's a trap. If I don't read, you'll all be disappointed. And if I do read, I'll have to be very careful because there'll have to be the poems that interest me. And I'm not so sure from recent experience that they're the poems which interest anyone. I don't feel I'm free, but then I am, like, it's not a captive audience so much as a captive poet, I think. I've been working for quite a few years on a poem. I have no impression of how much this book is Can someone give me some sense of how much you know the Maxim's poems? I'm really fishing because if I go to the fifth volume, instead of the first, and the first is unknown, it's awkward for you, I believe.
I think probably it's fairly little known.
Yeah, yeah. The general proposition is to address yourself, or I think this creature, Maximus, addresses himself to a city, which in the instance is Gloucester, which then in turn happens to be Massachusetts, that is Gloucester, Massachusetts. I'm not at all impressed that there's necessarily any more Gloucester, Massachusetts. Meaningful sense than the creature is either me or whom he originally was intended as, which was was Maximus of Tyre, a second century dialectician. At least on the record, what he wrote was dialethi, which we have, I guess, in the word dialectic, meaning intellectual essays or essays on intellectual subjects. And he mostly wandered around the Mediterranean world from the center, from the old capital of Tyre, talking about one thing, Homer's Odyssey. I don't have much more impression of him than that. I've tried to read his dialethi and found them not as interesting as I expected. But he represents to me some sort of a figure that centers much more than the second century A.D. In fact, as far as I feel it, like he's like the navel of the world. And in saying that, I'm not being poetic or loose. We come from a whole line of life which makes Delphi that center. I guess I can say that amongst you and be heard. And this, I think, is the kind of a thing that ought to be at least disturbed. I stress this part of it rather than what maybe just to make it possible for you to ignore the fact that you don't know. Most of you don't know these poems, so I might be free to read a few of the fifth volume to start us off. Because what I arrived at in these recent poems is something that is a transfer for me to that vision of a difference that Tyre is, or proposition that Tyre is, as against, like, say, Delphi. And if I can find the beginning of this volume, I'd like to run a few of those poems. I read in Toronto just a few weeks ago. Again, after 2 years, and Toronto is one of the great places on this continent, or was 2 years ago. And in reading. There, at that time, I had read a poem from this volume. Which includes a poem of John Smith. Now, John Smith was that man who had to do with Pocahontas, and was, as nobody seems to know, the governor of the Virginia colony shortly thereafter. And in an explosion of ammunition on the James River was so badly burned, he had to go back to London. In fact, almost like burned more than half his body, that sort of thing. And he went back and he was cured. And then became the great explorer of the North Atlantic and mapped the Gulf of Maine, Massachusetts Bay, as thoroughly as he had earlier mapped Chesapeake for the Virginia colony, and became by appointment the Admiral of New England, having been the governor of the Virginia plantation. And after one voyage for what was set out for Wales in 1614, he never was able to get back to America again. And in fact was refused by the Pilgrims in 1620 as an advisor. In fact, he would like very much to have been able to come over again, knowing the whole situation as their Miles Standish, but it was a more complicated role. And Smith is one of my heroes. And I had read this poem, which is published in Smith's last book, the day of the year of his death, 1629 or 30. And it's called The Sea Mock. Aloof, aloof, and come no near, the dangers do appear. Which if my ruin had not been, you had not seen. I only lie upon this shelf to be a mark to all which on the same might fall, that none may perish but myself. If in or outward you be bound, do not forget to sound. Neglect of that was cause of this to steer amiss. The seas were calm, the wind was fair, that made me so secure, that now I must endure all weathers, be they foul or fair. The winter's cold, the summer's heat, alternatively beat upon my bruised sides that rue, because too true, that no relief can ever come. But why should I despair, being promised so fair, that there should be a day of doom? And when I read that, it sits in another poem.
That's kind of a taste of it. I don't want to keep you here all night.
I never heard that him read the Seymour. That was great. The phrasing of that was beautiful. How far did you get with that, Willie?
I just remember he was looking for stuff and looking for stuff. I don't remember him actually reading anything. Mm-hmm. Is that the beginning of all the tapes?
Yeah.
It is. That must have been what I heard. I just didn't have patience at the time. Little did I know, Henry would put me up to singing some of this stuff 40, 50 years later. understanding because I would repeat it and repeat it and stuff like that. But the only reason I was interested in him was because, I mean, when I was 20, I bought The Distances and I got Maximus poems, and the only reason that I had was in Gloucester when I was a boy, and I know what the Sawyer Free Library was and stuff like that. And those things I understand. And that's why I would read them. And then finally, you know, I got the big thick one, which I haven't gotten all the way through. I just dip into it now and again.
So you've been singing?
Huh?
You've been singing these poems?
Henry had me doing the Gravelly Hill Dogtown thing, and then I made a recording of letter number 27.
Mm-hmm.
With, the other one I was in his movie, it's got like huge guitars and stuff. It's big, like only fitting to be big. The other one, it's got a beatbox behind it and, you know, weird samples and stuff. It's different. But I think I might redo that one, put the big guitars in it. All minor chords, and I never use those too, so it's special stuff.
Huh.
Hmm. Carol, did you say the whole reading is available in Penn Sound? Is it available anywhere online, the whole thing?
Or yeah, it's on. It's all on Penn Sound now.
It's on the. We have it at the. We have. I haven't listened to the version that we have at the writers at the library. But all of Ralph's tapes we've digitized, and probably in redundant to what Penn Sound did, but I actually haven't gone through.
Well, they don't have that much Olson at Penn Sound, surprisingly. I think only like half a dozen readings or so.
But they have this one's available there, right?
This one, yeah. But I'd imagine Ralph has a lot more than that.
Yeah, that's some research that we have to do, as we digitized about 10 or 15 recordings.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you know what I mean, though? It's like, before we had the computers, you know, like, if someone you knew had, like, a poetry cassette tape, and they would dub it for you, that was, like, a huge deal. You know, you'd call up your friend and be like, hey, guess what I got in the mail? You know, like, let's take a drive and, like, listen to this. You know, and now it's like, just Penn Sound alone has more hours of poetry than I could listen to in a lifetime, you know. You take it for granted, but...
Yeah.
Are there other published transcripts of the Goddard College lectures? I thought I had read them somewhere.
Yeah, Ralph Ma did a version in the minutes of the struggles, how would I say it? It was briefer, you know, like
right.
the whole shebang was maybe 20 pages long or something like that, and
so Ralph had a tape, or did he go there?
I think Ralph listened to the same recording that I listened
to. Okay.
Yeah.
Because he was following Olson around the Northeast for a while.
Oh. It's possible that he was there. I really don't
know.
But.
Well, in 62, he probably would have been still in Buffalo.
Exactly. He was hired by the English department in Buffalo, and he started to travel and go various places with Olson in the next 3 or 4 years, I think.
Hmm. Well, anyways, I guess like the third thing I wanted to do tonight, and we can talk and definitely do like questions and stuff, but I'd rather just do that over a drink and hang out. But I guess like the thing I wanted to ask you all is if you would feel comfortable just talking about an experience in your life that changed the way you thought about knowledge or learning.
So can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, it's Phil's story. So I grew up in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, firmly in the middle of Trump country now. And I went to a rather repressive Catholic school, probably no worse than the public education at the time, I don't think. I survived it. But we had a rather senile librarian, and you could wander all you wanted if you were in study hall. That's another function she had, which is what I was doing. And I was in a hall room storage area of the library, probably freshman in high school. Digging around in a box of books. I was quite a reader at that time anyway, and came across an anthology of poetry that we were decidedly not using as part of the curriculum, and I flipped it open, and didn't think much of poetry at the time, but the very first poem I lit upon was E.E. Cummings' Buffalo Bill. Buffalo Bill's defunct, he used to shoot 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pigeons just like that. And it proceeds there, ends up with the line, "How do you like your blue-eyed boy now, Mr. Death?" I was hooked. That's all it took, just reading that poem. And so I had to read everything he ever wrote, and that led from one thing to another. And I think the best moments of learning is when you are left to your own devices to discover what you need to discover. So that's what I want to say about that.
I think that probably the experience I had that taught me more about looking at the world in a different way was after I got out of school. And I got out of school in 71 and ended up with a job on a lobster boat out of Beverly Harbor. And just being in the real world where it wasn't intellectual, it wasn't abstract, it was a bunch of creatures coming up from whatever was in the trap, and you know, you pulled out the lobsters and you threw away the crabs, and you were out there in the elements, and there was no messing around. I mean, there was nothing intellectual about it. It was just, if you put your traps in the right place, you got lobsters, and if you didn't, you wasted your time. And when the wind was blowing the wrong way, I was puking over the side of the boat, and everything was just very real. It was very, very different than the academic, you know, the previous 17 years in school, and it definitely changed the way I looked at the world.
Jim Creamer. A different way I looked at the world evolved from being a conscientious objector against the Vietnam War, and then when I didn't have to do that anymore, I became a tenant organizer in Roxbury in Boston. And at that time, there was a great fuel crisis, and price of fuel was going up tremendously. And this is early 70s, and so we got a call at this tennis association I worked at, and I think I was earning about $23 a week or something, but rent was cheap, and I got a call, and that house had frozen. And I went to this house. It was a two-family house. And the family were African-Americans. And they were all huddled in the kitchen because that was the only source of heat. And the oven was on. And that was the only, that was what was heating the place. And there were no water running, no heat, except for that. And we managed to find a place for the mother and the girl children, but the son couldn't go into the shelter with the mother for some reason. So we sat at the kitchen table, and I played chess with a 14-year-old boy. And I watched as the ceiling crawled with roaches, because the roaches knew where to go to in the heat. And it sort of taught me a little bit about what the world was like that I had never seen before in academia and intellectual pursuits. And so it sort of changed my direction. That was my education on some of the facts of life.
I guess I should go. Hardly. Seems like we're going down the line. It I think sometimes we learn, it takes years to learn what we need to learn from things that happen to us or with us or around us. And it's probably, I would say the thing that changed my life learning was the death of my friend Galen. Learning what can be taken immediately, how little you control, and how you can't let that stop you from fighting to make it better still. So that's pretty much from tragedy, not falling into apathy or unrelenting sorrow, but moving in a direction that might make something better, as futile as it seems.
Do you have any lessons? Not to take the microphone.
I'm going to tell an anecdote that I don't know if it's as deeply moving as what we've heard, but I always loved an island I lived on as a child up in the Acadia Park region. And when I was maybe 19 or 20, I met a young woman who was 24 or 25, and we'd walk around the bogs and the salt marshes, and it was just such an exciting moment to discover another pitcher plant or cotton-tufted sedge. And like the passion came with these observations in nature and the excitement we shared over the observations. And then later on, I was able to have the exact same experience with a poet that many of you know. His name was Ted Enslin. We spent hours tromping through woods and bogs and discovering things. And then, this is just all together, you know, we were sharing, and that's all I'm trying to say. Once, very near the end of his life, I smelled the salt spray and the cherry tobacco in his beard as we hugged and said goodbye, because he was hitchhiking, even at that age, back up to his home. And that was it, you know. All of those, you use the word trobar. Some people have used the word trobar clue or quo, and we know that that's typical of the sort of hidden messages of love in troubadour poetry. And I think all of these nature experiences and to be able to say Latin names out loud in the wild, it was all part of a trobar clo kind of love experience that I've had with various individuals. I mean, I've taken a poet you would think is arcane and uninterested, and this is Charles Bernstein and his wife Susan, through these same bogs, and they were both irradiated with joy. So that's my story.
Well, I grew up a little bit farther down on Cape Ann in a family that had tons of books. Everywhere there were books, and they were available to all of us. I had three brothers, and two of them went to Goddard, which we were just talking about, and back in the 60s. And, you know, I assumed everybody either had books or had access to them. To the library, because I went to the, always remember going to the public library when I was very small, and they had a reading group. After college, I was a social worker, a caseworker for child welfare. And I had a family with, I think, seven children. I had five of them, and another caseworker had the others in a separate district. And we had to move one of the children. The foster mother had decided that the child was retarded and she wasn't going to work with him at all. So I found another home, and he did very well. But I had, you know, explained to the natural mother this was going to happen. And she and her husband had a common law marriage, which at the time was, you know, in upstate New York, very rural area, was entirely legitimate and recognized. So she didn't understand, apparently. So I said, well, I better go out and explain again. And I had written that this is what we were going to do, and that was our policy, because it had to be clear, and it had to be, you know, they had to have a document that they could use. So I went out there. They didn't have electricity, and they didn't have inside water, and they had sort of built this house over the years of what they found on the road. It had been a house, and then they'd added rooms here and there. And I started to explain. I saw this sort of dark figure in sort of a shed in the back attached to the house, and I thought, well, you know, he's whoever it is, he's wants to stay out there, and that's fine. So the mother was there in the what was the kitchen, and they did have a Franklin stove. And so I'm explaining to her, and she's looking at me, and she'd say a few words, and so I'd explain some more. And after about half an hour of this, I realized the problem was that she didn't have any language. She had so little intellectual connection that she didn't have any language. No matter what I said to her, she might sort of understand it, but she couldn't come back with words. The children went to school. They did okay. The older ones, and to this day, I still don't know if it's right or not, but it wasn't my decision. They, even though they were ostensibly in my caseload, they had decided that it was too late to do anything with these two girls and a boy, and they would just let them go their way. Now, they did have language, and they did pass most of their courses in school. And I don't know how they talked to their parents, but that dark figure outside was the husband and was afraid to come in because he didn't have any language. He couldn't respond. I've always remembered that, you know. And when we lived in Philadelphia, I remember, you know, sometimes, you know, we'd be out walking late at night coming home from something, which really wasn't the thing to do in Philadelphia in the 70s at night, but, you know, there we were. And I'd hear some African Americans talking, and they had so little language. They couldn't get your muscles, you know, your speech muscles are formed as children. And if nobody talks to you and you don't talk to them, you don't get that. You don't get those muscles. And if you don't say the words, you don't have the thought that goes with them. And I've always thought about that. I think you know, we think books are the thing. I think speech is the thing. Read to them, talk to them, but people need to hear the words. So that was my experience. I don't know what it's done for me, but there it is.
So I also went to Catholic school in Pennsylvania outside of Philadelphia, and I was a weird kid, you know. In first grade, Sister Mary Regis was really strict. I was left-handed, and I also, I like to put my hand in my pocket, which is a really bad thing to do. It's a sign of the devil, and also a sign that you're pleasuring yourself, so you also get hit a lot with the pointer. So I cried a lot in first grade. It was during the Vietnam War, 1971, St. John of the Cross in Roslyn, Pennsylvania. Sister Regis had an exercise, and the exercise was we were all assigned a letter of the alphabet, and we had to create a poem about the letter. So I was assigned letter K, so I figured this is my moment to shine. And even back then, I knew I can do this, you know. So I got up there, and I just went, K is for the kicking kangaroo who kicked himself straight out of the zoo. You better watch out. He kicked me, and he'll kick you, too. So all of a sudden, her whole countenance, her whole demeanor changed, and she was like, well, I think we have a real poet in the room. And everyone around me, I knew at that moment that words could get me out of a lot of trouble and make me not as weird as I inherently am. So that's my story.
That was probably about 7 years old. I lived at the time in Springfield, Massachusetts. And we lived in Winchester Square was an area that was highly diverse. We lived there during the time when all of the white people were leaving. And we lived next to it's called the Affleck Brock Field. It was from Springfield College, and a lot of the neighborhood kids would play around there because it was a great field, and we would go there. And it was highly racially charged at that time. But anyhow, a bunch of us kids were going over to the field. It was a bunch of white kids, and there were a bunch of black kids who were older, and they took our ball. It was this moment where everybody was so pissed off that they would call these kids names, call these kids niggers, these seven-year-old white kids, which I was involved with. And luckily, there was an older black kid who was there who lectured these younger white kids about the power of that word. And that had a huge impact on all of us. And it was that moment where everybody realized that that was not the way to conduct oneself.
We should like thread these stories together, you know, the tenements of poverty and shame and Catholic education seem to be coming up. I was a kid who had a patch over my left eye from the age of 4 to the age of 14, and I was going to a Catholic school, and it was lovely. And me and a best friend asked a couple of girls, all of us were fifth grade, right, 12, to go ice skating or something, and my friend and her friend just made out crazily. I didn't know what was going on, and neither did Madeline. And then the summer passes, and the fall comes along, and I look at her, and she looked at me, and then everybody learned that my family was being transferred again because we were military. And she gave me the sweetest gift. It was a little Merriam-Webster dictionary, pocket size, bound in leather, with gold print on it. And she wrote inside, "Because you love words." That's my Catholic school experience.
Still have?
I am.
You still have it?
No, I don't. Isn't that amazing?
Thank you.